wash those hands really well.
Do it often, and keep your hands away from your face.
That's advice from the Centers for Disease Control to guard against COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News.
The latest on the COVID-19 outbreak coming up.
It's primary day in South Carolina.
South Carolina has a thumb on the scale.
Hello, South Carolina State.
Thank you, Myrtle Beach.
What voters there do today could ripple through 14 more states when they vote on Tuesday.
And there's a deal being signed today between the U.S. and the Taliban, who harbored Al-Qaeda before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your day.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. Earn 5% back at Walmart online, 2% in Walmart stores, restaurants, and travel, and 1% everywhere else. What's in your wallet? Terms and exclusions apply.
Several more unexplained cases of the new coronavirus have cropped up on the West Coast, raising concerns that COVID-19 is now spreading in ways that are hard to control.
There are new cases in Washington State, Oregon, and California, and the disease is continuing to spread around the globe. The World Health Organization now reports cases in at least 56 countries.
We're joined now by NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Good morning, Scott.
First, please bring us up to date on these new cases in the U.S.
Yeah, well, it's been quite a week. Earlier this week, there was a case reported in Solano County, California. That's sort of midway between Sacramento and San Francisco. And that's raising concerns because that woman had never really come in contact with anybody who they knew had been exposed to the coronavirus. She hadn't traveled to China. She's now in the hospital, and people are really concerned about that. The CDC sent like 10 additional investigators out there to figure that out. But just as that story was starting to unfold late yesterday, California authorities talked about another presumptive case in San Jose, which is at the south end of San Francisco Bay, or in San Jose area, I should say. Then health departments in Washington and Oregon chimed in the wee hours. Oregon said there was an adult in Washington County, Oregon, who fell sick about 10 days ago and was tentatively diagnosed just yesterday with the coronavirus. And there are two cases in Washington, one a woman who traveled to South Korea, so that's not too surprising, but the other a person who was a high school student in Snohomish County, which you may recall seems like a long time ago, now was the site of the very first case identified in the United States.
Richard, all of that seems like a serious new turn of events. What's going on?
It could indeed be quite serious. Community spread is troublesome. To date, all the other travelers have been pretty well known. They've either been travelers to China or Japan on that cruise ship, or their spouses. Health officials can track folks in those circumstances because they can figure out who they've been in touch with and keep following up and make sure those people are keeping track of their own health and so on. But when cases start popping up at seeming random moments, that control method gets increasingly problematic. So question is this really the first sign of things going out of control? Or, you know, there's also a possibility that just there has been a long delay in testing. And now that states are starting to do testing, we're all of a sudden seeing a burst in new cases.
And what's behind the holdup in testing here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, tests are still officially run in Atlanta, which is why these are still presumptive tests. But the CDC produced some test kits some weeks ago, and they sent them out to the states, but they didn't work. And so the state said, we're not going to run them until you sort it out. CDC has taken a long time to figure out what exactly has been wrong with the kits they originally sent out. And they finally said, okay, we have the green light. You can go ahead and use those kits. They sent out new batches and so on. And so that's why we're seeing tests now. So that, unfortunately, that delay also means that there's been very little testing over the past several weeks beyond highly suspected cases. And so that's maybe why we're starting to see this outburst right now.
U.S. now has more than 60 cases of the coronavirus. Could you put that into perspective for us?
Well, clearly it's nowhere as bad as in China. And we've been seeing the last couple of weeks these other areas of outbreak like South Korea, Iran, and Italy, where cases are really rapidly multiplying. Since most cases here are still pretty well understood, most are, in fact, off the Diamond Princess cruise ship that was in Japan for a while, it's too early to panic, clearly. We should never panic, but it is a concern. And I think we'll learn a lot more as testing ramps up in the next week or two, really what the dimensions of this are here.
NPR's Richard Harris, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
For more advice on COVID-19 and preventing the spread of the coronavirus that causes it, just open this podcast feed again tomorrow. Our colleagues at LifeKit will have a special episode full of information you can use to protect yourself and your family. Polls are open in South Carolina.
It's the first Democratic primary in the South and the first contest where African-American voters make up a majority of the Democratic electorate.
So it's a big test for a number of candidates.
For more on what to watch as the day goes on, let's turn to NPR's Juana Summers, who's been covering the campaign throughout the state for some time. Juana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Biden says South Carolina is part of his path to win the nomination. How do things look for him right now?
Yes, Scott, there's no question that this state is a make or break one for Joe Biden. I've been here all week talking to folks who know the state well and folks who are backing Biden. They say he's in a really strong place. There have been several polls out in recent days that show him with a double-digit lead. A lot of that is owed to the strong grip he has on the state's Black voters. Here he is last night. He's doing a little math to urge students at Wofford College, that's in Spartanburg, and he's urging them to go to the polls.
If you vote this time in the same percentage 18 to 25-year-olds vote the same percentage that the rest of the population votes, it'll be 5.2 million more votes, and you can own it all.
Joe Biden is hoping that this state will give him momentum as the race moves on to the 14 states that have their say on Super Tuesday. He hasn't done as much groundwork there because he's been forced to spend almost all his time here.
Bernie Sanders lost to Hillary Clinton by 47 percentage points 4 years ago. What's this year look like for him?
Well, things look so much different for him this year. Bernie Sanders is coming off of a close race in Iowa and wins in New Hampshire and Nevada, so he's got a lot of momentum in this race for the nomination. He's the front runner right now. It's really clear that he's learned the lessons of 2016. I covered him then, and since then, he has kept his operation alive here in South Carolina. He and surrogates, those who back his campaign, have come back over and over again. 4 years ago, people didn't know him, and they know him here now. He is not favored to win this race, but he has substantially more support from Black voters this time around than 4 years ago. And that'll be key, not just in South Carolina, but in later states as the primary electorate grows more diverse.
And you've been on the road this week with Tom Steyer. Why is that businessman spending so much time there and so much money?
He is betting everything on South Carolina. He has been here more than any other candidate. He has the largest staff on the ground, more than 90 people, and he has spent $17 million on local broadcast TV ads alone. That is a bigger investment than anyone else. And all of that is to make a big play for Black voters. When you go out to a Tom Steyer event, he talks about reparations, the need to invest in historically Black colleges and universities, economic and racial justice. Last night, he held a Get Out the Vote concert at Allen University. It's one of the state's HBCUs. It was quite the party.
Win, lose, or draw, I fell in love with the people of South Carolina. I'm never leaving. Honestly, I am never leaving because this is a completely righteous fight. And we're going to win this fight.
Something a lot of people don't know is that Tom Steyer has actually been coming to South Carolina for years. Even before he was a presidential candidate, he came here for his climate change activism and with the Need to Impeach movement that he launched. And a lot of voters tell me they knew him even before he started running from that work.
South Carolina votes today, but Super Tuesday is just in 3 days, 14 other states. How do the candidates juggle this in their schedule? Because they have to travel truly between California and New York, then South Carolina.
Yeah, there's no question that there is a calendar crunch here, and that means candidates are having to make some strategic choices. Not all of them will be here today as the votes roll in. Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, they'll all spend primary night elsewhere. And we should note, Mike Bloomberg won't be that far away. He'll be in North Carolina. He is not competing for votes in South Carolina, but starting on Super Tuesday, he will be on primary ballots as well.
NPR's Juana Summers in South Carolina, thanks so much.
Thank y'all.
And for more on the campaign, be sure to check out the NPR Politics podcast wherever you get your podcasts. A deal is on the table today in Doha.
U.S. and Taliban officials are there in Qatar to sign an agreement that may lead to thousands of U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan. 18 years ago, the United States led a NATO force into that country because the Taliban refused to expel al-Qaeda leaders they were harboring.
Today's deal seeks to end America's involvement in Afghanistan. And NPR's Dia Hadid is in Qatar for the signing. She joins us now. Hi, Dia.
Hi there, Layla.
So describe the scene for us there. Where are you?
So we're in this enormous ballroom that's being converted for the press in the Sheraton Hotel. It's this ultra-modern building in Doha, Qatar. And we're waiting for the American delegation to get to the signing room, and that will be led by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. He'll be witnessing the ceremony. And to get a sense of how historic this is, there's been multiple attempts to negotiate with the Taliban over the years, but this is the first time a deal has been reached. And just visually, it's really remarkable. There was just a press gaggle around a senior Taliban leader. These are people you rarely see, even as journalists. I accidentally bumped into the Taliban liaison officer for Osama bin Laden in the lobby. He was there with a group of other Talibs while there were tourists snacking on the buffet, and there were American officials mingling about in suits. It's a really a remarkable sight.
So what happens next?
So initially, the Taliban say they expect thousands of their men to be released from Afghan prisons in exchange for about 1,000 Afghan security forces they've captured. And we expect a drawdown of American troops, about 4,000 of them, within the next 135 days, and the evacuation of five small forward operating bases, they're called. And we expect that NATO will be mirroring that with their own troops. There's more than 37 countries, though, represented in NATO forces, so it's a bit more complicated. After that initial drawdown, we've been told there'll be conditions-based withdrawals. And this is where it gets a bit tricky. It's going to be conditioned on the level of violence in Afghanistan and what Americans say are their counter-terrorism needs. They want to make sure that Al-Qaeda and ISIS won't be able to use Afghan soil as a sanctuary or a place to plot further attacks. But for the next few years, at least, the Afghan government says that the Americans have committed to be around for counterterrorism, for training, and for assistance with aerial strikes. And to that end, in Kabul today, as this ceremony takes place, the Defense Secretary Mark Esper will be there to sign a deal with the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani that's meant to reassure the government that they'll still be around.
And there's also a political track?
That's right. And so once this deal is signed, we expect that Afghans will have to start negotiating between themselves to end this conflict. Because although the Americans have been there for nearly two decades, this conflict has raged for more than four decades, more than 40 years in Afghanistan. Now it has to end. And so we expect by about mid-March that a delegation led by the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, will be negotiating with the Taliban. We expect it may happen in Oslo, although that hasn't been finalized. And those negotiations may take months, even years, because so many things have to be hammered out, from extending this partial ceasefire that's been holding for the past week to things like determining women's rights in a country where the Taliban have a say in the political future.
NPR's Dia Hadid in Doha, Qatar. Dia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Layla.
And that's a first for Leap Day, Saturday, February 29th, 2020. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Don't forget about the special episode of Life Kit in this feed tomorrow morning about the new coronavirus and how to keep it and other viruses from spreading.
You can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter. And of course, you know, the news doesn't stop just when this podcast ends. You know what? We got a solution for that.
Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Hi, this is Felix Contreras from NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. As part of our Black History Month coverage, we take a look at the Afro-Latin root of reggaeton and its rise over the last decade to become one of the most listened to musical genres on the planet. To check it out, download Alt Latino from wherever you get your podcasts.